Hey everybody, and welcome to Space Force. I'm Jason Tondro.
I'm Thea.
And I'm Jim. We have a special guest with us, Jim Johnson. Welcome aboard.
Thank you so much for having me, Jason and Thea. Really appreciate it.
So, Jim, you are the project manager for the Star Trek Adventures RPG, I believe. Is that right?
That's right. Yep. I've been the project manager for about 2 years now, and I've been involved with the game from the beginning. I started off as a writer and a freelance writer and editor, and just gradually made myself more and more invaluable. And then they promoted me, which is, it's been a great journey, and it's a lot of fun, and looking forward to seeing what comes next.
Yeah. It's a little scary sometimes to get promoted on a thing that you love. I know.
Yeah.
Star Trek Adventures has been a wonderful game. It's well supported now. We've got lots of books for every division, has the Shackleton Expanse book come out yet?
Yep, it came out. We put it on pre-order in like October, and then the print edition came out in November-ish. So it's out there now in distribution. Yeah,
it hasn't showed up at my local game store yet, but I'm looking for it every week.
I'm sure it's on the way.
Yeah. There's a starter box, the new Klingon hardcover core rulebook made some errata and minor improvements to the rules. Mm-hmm. And then there's a beautiful sort of tricorder box set. Can you tell us about that, baby?
Yeah, so the tricorder box set, that's been a long time in the makings. That's kind of our love letter to original series fans. Because like the original conceit of the series is that, the game system itself covers all Star Trek for everybody, right? All the Star Trek series. But we wanted to do something kind of special for the original series. And so we figured out, we would do it would look like the tricorder, the classic original series tricorder. And it has a flip open lid and it's got a rules digest, the full rules digest inside it, a three-part adventure and a bunch of other stuff just packed into it. And plus Kirk's, we did a special edition dice for it, which is Kirk's green and gold uniform, right? Yeah. So we got 5d20, and a bunch of six-siders in there. But yeah, we wanted to do a special thing for original series fans because we have to try to appeal to everybody in some way. Sure. So we thought kind of a premium product with the original series stylings and layout and design and everything would be nice. So that's on pre-order now. And the last I heard, it's finally shipped from the manufacturers in China, and it's on a boat. Somewhere on the Pacific, the tricorders are making their way to America and to the UK.
Well, that just sounds fantastic. And obviously you guys really love Star Trek and you love the genre and want to connect with fans. And I think that's wonderful.
Absolutely.
Thea, I think you bought the big Borg cube when that thing came out.
I did. I did buy the giant Borg cube when that came out. And it's still mostly in its wrapping, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, keep it safe.
But we are here to talk about Star Trek Discovery. The latest episode of Star Trek Discovery, Choose to Live. And I cannot tell you how excited I was when I read that title, because I am a huge fan of the characters from Star Trek Picard, which introduced that phrase, and the Romulan monastic order that we meet in that show and which returned here. I remember when I first saw it on Picard, I was thinking, okay, there are now thousands of women figuring out how to cosplay their membership in the Malat, and I just think that's wonderful how it expands the setting and makes a new, wonderful, imaginative addition that people can really get into. And I knew that we'd be making up, how to make them character creation rules. For how to make them in Star Trek Adventures. And I logged into Star Trek Online and it took me about 10 minutes to find somebody whose background said that they were a member of the Malat, And I just love it. I think fans just really embraced it. But this episode, it's a very interesting, I don't know about you guys, but I felt like it was, every episode seems to get better. So ostensibly, there's a couple of things going on. We collected all this data from the anomaly at the end of last episode. And so Stamets and Book are trying to figure that out. We're taking it to the Vulcan Romulan homeworld. And we're going to try to figure out what's up with it. What is this thing? And Stamets has a theory. But there's a whole nother subplot involved in which has nothing, it appears at first to have nothing to do with the major plot of the season, the anomaly, a member of the Malat, which I keep forgetting the whole name.
The co-op Milot.
That's it. Yeah. That's a co-op Milot. Thank you. A member of the co-op Milot with a few of her assistants show up and they kill a Starfleet officer to steal a shipment of dilithium. And this provokes a bit of a diplomatic incident because the Federation needs to go get this woman, but the Vulcan president wants the ways of the co-op Milot to be respected. And like, well, how do we do this? We want the Vulcans to and the Romulans to join the Federation. So how do we negotiate this in a way that doesn't ruin diplomatic relations between the Federation and this prospective member, prominent and highly respected returning member? And eventually this turns into a hunting party. Classic PC situation with the captain and Tilly going off with a couple of with her mother, and they eventually are able to discover that this is a classic lost cause situation. And fans of Picard will remember the Co-op Milot's obsession with lost causes. There's apparently an entire alien species which has been put on cryogenics asleep on a starship the size of a moon, and they've been discovered by a member of the Co-op Milot, and she dedicates herself to saving these people and getting them out of the way of the anomaly. And that caused a lot of bloodshed, as apparently they don't know how to do anything if it doesn't involve stabbing people. But ultimately, we're able to resolve this situation, and she is, the alien species is reawakened and allowed to settle their new planet. They are brought out of cryogenic suspension. And the Co-op Milot killer is taken into custody willingly. She willingly surrenders herself into custody. There's a lot going on. It's a fury, and we haven't even touched on the Gray subplot. So there's a lot going on this episode. Maybe we should just start with, you know, what did you all think about it? Thea, do you want to start us off? What were your first reaction to this episode?
I think this is easily Discovery at its best. I think it really helps that Michelle Paradise has stayed on from season 3 to season 4. And I think there was that consistency. I think, well, as you said, the show was getting better each episode. And if you had told me 2 years ago that there would be an episode of Star Trek Discovery that has 3 subplots and is only tied together through a theme, and I would have said that would have been too much. It would have been too much because Discovery up to now has not shown a lot of restraint in how it handles those subplots. And this episode was beautifully constructed from beginning to end. And I think it's a really good episode.
Jim?
Yeah, I thought it was a really good episode in that, they've got some really good actors on this show, right? And they finally are getting, not finally, but they're getting an opportunity to do a lot of stuff. Yeah. And not so much just like the shooting, the pew-pew, and the solving big stories. Like, they can do really intimate moments and really personal moments. And, like, the scene, I'm assuming we can just go crazy with spoilers, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah, okay. The scene with Adira and Gray, right? Yeah. Once Gray is fully together, like, you can just see the act, like the emoting coming out of the screen was like, wow, they're so into this moment. And it was just great to see that, just to see, you know, actors just doing their thing. You know, obviously they're professionals, but it's just a treasure to see that when you can see it on screen and putting it all out there to see. And I love the fact, this is actually kind of an aside, but I love the fact that the Co-op Milot, you know, 32nd century Discovery, like, their preferred weapon is a melee weapon. And it's like, it reminds me of the Klingons a little bit, but it's like everyone else has got phasers and everything. And like, no, they're still using good old time-tested katanas, you know? And it's I appreciate that because it's just a nice anachronism to the setting.
Well, and it immediately is going to appeal to a lot of fans everywhere, yeah. Right? Like, yeah, because, yeah. You know, we all know players that they always want to be the melee character. And they don't care how good your phaser is. I want to have a sword. Mm-hmm. And with a movie like Dune in the theaters as we speak, like, there is an appeal to sword fighting in space. I don't know what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So this episode reminded me a lot of the Next Generation episode Family. Where you're right after Best of Both Worlds, Picard goes down to Earth, he sees his brother, and then there's a couple other subplots happening on the ship. Yeah. You don't see the bridge at any point. And episode at any point, which made me think, oh, this is a that you can't really do until you're further into a series, right? You couldn't do this in like season one because you just don't know the characters that well. And I love the fact that the producers were willing to spend an entire hour not necessarily advancing the season's plot at all, right? Like you get a little bit with Stamets realizing that he's hit a dead end, right? That's what it is, you know, effectively that failed in a way in that they didn't get the answer they were looking for. But everything else was subplot driven, which is really, really cool to see. Cause I know that, you know, like a lot of Star Trek episodes or a lot of Star Trek series, right? They just don't have the time to devote an entire episode to just subplots. And then, you know, as opposed to like the Alien of the Week or the Monster of the Week or the Planet of the Week or whatever.
Sure.
Or if you're into a longer storyline like DS9 and Enterprise, you know, where you could do a full season of stories, you don't always have that kind of time to just stop, take a breath, do some little really intimate character stuff, and then get on with the next big set piece, right? So I really appreciate that the producers were willing to spend some time to give the characters really key, important moments. I think they missed a couple opportunities, honestly.
Yeah.
But I think what we got was really good.
Yeah, Thea has mentioned more than once that phrase, giving the show time to breathe.
Mm-hmm.
That Discovery often hasn't had that, and the talk has suffered from that. We spent a lot of time talking last season about the short shrift given to all the characters with their many subplots that turned into like, often the subplots turned into kind of a nothing burger, you know, like there wasn't really anything going on there. There was a lot more of us speculating about a subplot than any actual subplot.
Mm-hmm.
And I really feel like this season has benefited from shrinking the focus of cast members. We lost a couple people, like, you know, people on the bridge that I would love to see more of, but we don't really, they're not really getting plots anymore. It's really like, you know, we've got Book and Stamets, Gray and Adira, I can't believe I've forgotten his name.
Culber.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Culber. And of course, the captain and our first officer,
Saru.
And that's kind of really it. That's the cast. And by reduced by maybe losing a few people like the helmsman and so on, we've been able to focus in and give those characters more time. And also everything's not about Burnham anymore, right? Like we can have scenes in which characters are talking about something that has nothing to do with Burnham, which seems to have been pretty rare in previous seasons of the show. Anyway, so one of the things that I was really struck by, Jim, we brought you on. One of the reasons why we brought you on is, I never got to ask you this. So how did you first encounter Star Trek? Like, what's your Star Trek story? How did you encounter all of this?
I grew up on reruns of the original series, right? Okay. I always talk about how, I first started off, I was a kid in New York City, and I had a cheap little 3-inch black and white portable television with the old aerial that you could aim the aerial around and try to get the signal, right?
I had one in my bedroom. I watched Carl Sagan's Cosmos.
I apologize. Your video froze a little bit, but you had a TV, okay? So if I aimed the aerial just right, I would get a grainy rerun or something if it was in syndication at the time. And so that's what I started off with. Like my friends and I would play on the playground playing Kirk, Spock, and McCoy on a landing party, you know, going in. From there, you know, I started reading a lot of the books that were coming out in the 70s and the 80s and the 90s, reading just a lot of Star Trek books when I was working at a bookstore. And from there, you know, I started writing. You know, I got into writing around college time, and I got a couple of short Star Trek short stories published, and ended up meeting a bunch of the other writers through that, and just kept going that way. And about the same time, you know, I was getting into the RPG industry and doing writing, and eventually found my way to working for Modiphius on the Star Trek Adventures game, and then, you know, just progressed on that. And then they promoted, like we said earlier, promoted me to program manager, and now I'm responsible for the, you know, creative direction of the whole line, which is really hard to believe. Like every day I wake up and I'm grateful to be in this position, because like I've played every version of the Star Trek RPG for the last 30 odd years, and now this is the next one. It's like, oh, okay, now I'm I'm trying to do my best to take the team and like build on the shoulders of giants, right? Because like there's been so many great games over the last, you know, or somewhere down the road, somebody else will do the next one, right? And hopefully we're giving them a worthy thing to continue on with, right? But
when you said that you used to get some short stories published, mm-hmm. where did those stories come out? What was your venue for that?
Yeah, so in the late 90s, early zeros, aughts, whatever you call it, Simon & Schuster had the bright idea to do a short story contest, a short story anthology called Strange New Worlds. And at the time, the primary editor was John Ordover, and Dean Wesley Smith was a longtime Star Trek writer and also, you know, professional writer for a bunch of other stuff. And Dean and John had the great idea to do this anthology. So what they did is they opened it up to the fans and they said, hey, if you think you can write a professional grade short story, you know, up to like 7,500 words or something, mail it in just like you would any professional story submission. The editors will look at it. They'll pick the best, you know, 15 to 20 stories, and we'll publish it, and we'll pay you professional rates and get your, you know, professional writing career started. And it proved to be popular enough that they did 10 of these things. So for 10 years, they ran this anthology, and Dean consistently was getting, I don't know, 5,000 to 10,000 submissions a year. And like the submission window was only like from like, I think it was like August to October or something. It was a really short submission window. But I remember, you know, a bunch of us, you know, I started a Yahoo group. This is how far back it was, right? I started a Yahoo group for Strange New Worlds writers. And I said, hey, anybody who's pursuing this, let's just, you know, collectively get our heads together and support each other. And it really reminded me of when Paramount, right, they had when Voyager and DS9 and Next Gen were on the air. Paramount, if I remember right, was the only show in town, like in Hollywood, that was open to submissions to spec scripts from fans, right? So if you were a fan, you could write a spec script, mail it to you know, Next Gen or DS9 or Voyager, and the writing staff would actually spend part of their day reading spec scripts, or at least reading, you know, the treatments that the interns would read. And if they liked your stuff, they would invite you in to pitch, right? So that's how Ron D. Moore got his start. Is he wrote a spec script, sent it in, and they invited him to pitch. So they kind of like carried that tradition forward, where they were like, we want the fans to be contributing to the novel line or to the series, to the storyline. So they opened it up, and you know, a whole bunch of Strange New Worlds writers went on to write novels. Like Dayton Ward is the key one, is the primary one I can think of. He got into three Strange New Worlds anthologies, and then he went on to write a whole bunch of novels for Star Trek, right? And just based on that series, and that's how I ended up meeting so many people like Dayton and Keith DeCandido and Kevin Dillmore and a whole bunch of other folks that I've invited. Now that I've got these professional relationships and friendships, I was able to bring them along on the ride for Star Trek Adventures, right? So it just worked out. But anyway, that was a long-winded answer to say that the venue was Strange New Worlds. That for 10 years, that was the only way to get Star Trek short stories published professionally. Like otherwise, everything else would have been fanfic that you'd have to post online for free, because you can't, you know, there's no other venue for Star Trek fiction that you could at least get paid for.
You wrote the piece with Picard talking to Scotty and Bones about Kulk's death, didn't you?
You read that. Yes, that was my first one. That was in Strange New World 7. That was...
Yep. I knew, like, the name was familiar. And once you said Strange New Worlds, my brain started firing. And then I was like, I need to get confirmation on this, because I love that story.
Great.
Oh, thank you. Well, I appreciate that. Yeah, and you know what? Literally, you're just talking about it. And I've just blanked on the title. I'm gonna have to pull it off my crack shelf. I can't remember the title. But yeah, that Picard story was my first professional sale. So that holds a special place in my heart. Yeah, thank you.
You know, Thea's job on this show. Like Thea is here to be the Star Trek expert, and I'm here to ask dumb
questions. Well, there's like two approaches to like Star Trek fiction that you can take. You can either, like Michael Chabon says, you know, stitch together the continuity a little bit, and that's what that story does. Or you can tell a bold new adventure and not worry about the continuity so much. Mm-hmm. And I love that piece. And I think you also did the Brain Attack
on Earth. Yeah. Data? Yeah.
Yeah. Right. Yep. Yeah. So what you did was you took the continuity and you were like, I'm just going to stitch it here. And that's what I loved about those pieces. And that's why they stand out in the memory, because It's you have two approaches, and you always seem to take the more humanistic approach.
Thea, you've made my year. to remember those two little short stories that were in anthologies that, let's be honest, didn't sell a whole lot, but they were doing it for the
love. I bought every one of them. I submitted every year. None of my stories got in, but I was a big proponent, and it was an exciting time. I remember that Yahoo group. Like, I don't remember posting on it because I was more of less engaged on the internet, but I do remember that Yahoo group.
Wow. See, the world is so small. Here it is. You were in that Yahoo group, and I thought, man, I started that thing so long ago, and I had such a good time. We had like 100-something writers in that group, and like collectively, they wrote, we must have written like 1,000 stories in that group by itself and sent it all off to Dean. I know a bunch of them went on to have really happy careers as writers. I was just so grateful for that community, right? It was a community that we all got smarter together, and it was just so much fun. So thank you so much for making my day, man. I tell you it's great to hear. Like, you know, as a writer, it's always nice to hear somebody say, "Oh, I read your stuff and I remember it." But like, that was 10, 12 years ago, something. And so thank you. I really appreciate it.
We'll rein it back a little bit and get back to our show. But I mean, this is great stuff. I was really struck. You were talking about, Jim, about the quality of the acting in this particular episode. Mm-hmm. I loved the conversation that went on between Book, as Book was figuring out kind of what he needed. And when we got to see the mind meld, there was a little bit of nerd in me that just was screaming the entire time, right? As soon as she starts to do the mind meld. But you're right. Like, there was fantastic performances brought in there, and I found it interesting that we had sort of two moments in the show, like where Tilly is hearing about the absolute candor, and for a minute you wonder if she's gonna because she's kind of in search of a new path for herself. This is kind of her subplot. I think Thea nailed this in the first episode. Actually, Thea, you were suggesting that she's gonna end up getting chosen to be the captain of that new Voyager starship. And I think you might be right. Every episode I see more evidence that that's what might happen. But for a minute I was like, is she going to like try and go for absolute candor here and take a huge leap? Meanwhile, Book is asking to learn like the Vulcan way of logic. And there was this wonderful moment where, the Romulan president clarifies to him, look, your people are empathic. You are all about emotion. You trying to follow the path of logic is the absolute worst thing you could ever do. That would be a complete betrayal of you and what your people stand for. And this really helped me clarify what Thea was talking about last episode with it, in the sense that Book is this show's McCoy, and the show's Spock is I've forgotten his name, our first officer.
Saru.
That Saru's our Spock.
Remember together.
I know. Yeah, you're right. Yeah, I have to. I don't know. That Saru is the show's Spock, and Book is the show's McCoy, in the sense that they're emotion and logic on opposite sides. And then Burnham is the one that has to sort of make the decision and be the center point, the fulcrum on which those two characters kind of balance. And it helped clarify it. And I thought that we're really sort of figuring out how the show is constructed and mechanic and structurally how the show is written. There was one other thing that I wanted to kind of get at, which is I'm having a hell of a time this today. Like, every time I want to talk about something, it's just jumping right out of my head. Thea, I'm going to pass the buck. What'd you think? You want to get into something more in detail on this episode?
I want to talk about the theming of the episode.
Okay, good.
So, yes, the title of the episode was Choose to Live. And that's sort of the central theme. Like, yes, the fan portion of it is tied to the Quantmalot, and it's tied to their choice. And they talk about it a little bit at the end of the episode. But the phrase that kept coming in my head was recall to life, which is a phrase that Dickens uses twice in A Tale of Two Cities. One when Dr. Manette is rescued from the Bastille, and then one when a character finds love. So there's the physical recall to life, like he gets to live his life free of the prison, And then there was the metaphorical recall to life of finding love. And every plot point, every subplot in this episode has someone making that choice that, you know, they're choosing to live, they're being recalled to life, they're being given something that they need to live a more balanced, more full life, to the point where the plot of this episode is bringing people out of hibernation so that they can settle this planet that they had chosen for themselves. Like, that's the big, so like, it's thematically, it's so tied into all these concepts of Gray needs a body. Gray chooses the danger. Like, it was a very searchful spot.
Yeah.
Like, I choose the danger moment. And, you know, Book has to rediscover not a romantic love, but he has to rediscover his, like, the lost memory that he's been haunted by. And that allows him a familial love. And that's what brings him peace. And like, Tilly has to be like, okay, I do have a function. I'm not a failure. I can still do this. Sometimes I have my friends and my colleagues to help guide me on that road. But if I'm honest with myself and I'm honest with what I need, I can figure it out.
Yeah.
So like, it was just wonderfully constructed. I don't think there was a minute wasted. Is there things I would have done differently? Sure. But that's because I'm a writer. And I'm like, okay, you got three subplots. You have three different Vulcanians living on this planet. Let's have a Vulcanian interacting with each subplot. You already have the Romulan woman with the Tilly plot. You already have the Vulcan president. Let's get that third, you know, that third class. You know, let's get them with the Gray plot. You know, let's really go in Star Trek 3. But again, minor quibble. Like,
yeah,
not even worth the trouble.
My main quibble with the thing was at the very end when Burnham's mother reveals that she had a secret motive for bringing Burnham along. Well, according to the absolute candor principles, she should have said that. She should not have kept that a secret, right? Like, because absolute candor is not just always telling the truth. It's always unburdening whatever is on your mind. And but, you know, okay, maybe she's not quite as act. She's also fairly new to the absolute candor thing. So let's cut her some slack, Jim.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and she's human, right? We don't really know how many non-Romulan co-op Melot there are. Like, is Gabrielle Burnham the exception, or is the order open to everybody? And she just happens to be, you know, we don't know that quite know that detail yet. But
that's right. Yeah.
That's
the sort of detail that we leave open so that gamers can come in and decide for themselves, right?
Yeah, and that's the great danger, right? Like for those of us who are actually, you know, writing the game, right? We want to try to adhere to canon as much as possible. And so the challenge is, like, if we do a product and we make a guess and then they contradict it on screen, we're like, well, we did the best we could. Just, you know that we're a year behind, right? So we can only do so much. But no, great world building is always a lot of fun. And we saw some world building in this episode that I wasn't expecting.
Yeah.
Notably, the whole Trill thing. Like, the whole Trill thing fascinates me. And what really fascinated me is that the Guardian Z, was able to hologram in. So he's basically just communicating, but his senses are so strong that he's able to sense what's happening with Gray, even though he's just a hologram. You know, tuning in from, you know, millions of light years or whatever.
Yeah.
So I was just like, wow, he's got, his abilities are able to project that far that he's able to sense what's happening with Gray. One detail I missed, and I'm going to have to watch it again because I can't remember, is I can't remember if it was just Gray's consciousness that went into the synthetic body or if it was the symbiote too. I wasn't clear if the symbiote is still with Adira or if the symbiote transferred over to Gray. Do either of you know offhand?
They did not say anything about Tall making the migration over, because in the previous episode, Gray mentions that he can be rejoined. You know, he can be joined again.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's the phrase that's used, is joined again. That sort of implies that it's a different symbiote that he could be, you know, a member of.
Interesting. Okay, so it's probably still Adira Tall then, and then just Gray.
Yeah, one of I thought the weaker points of the episode, even though, like, the acting and the emotions, well, everything I wanted to be, was the The exposition of what was happening was never clear. Like, at least with Star Trek III, and that's sort of like my touchstone to go back to, is because we had to transfer consciousness over from one body to a new body. That was wrapped up in Vulcan mysticism, right? Like, there was, we saw what was happening. We may not have understood as the audience, but we knew that something was happening, and we had to wait it out. Whereas this, whatever the thing was, occurred off camera, and I didn't quite... it leaves a lot of questions, Jim. Like, did the symbiote go or whatnot?
Yeah.
I think the other problem is, so there's no exposition on the subplot, but then Bonham gives us expository exposition that's a conjectural. Like, when she's confronting the Quat'Malot at the very end of the episode, she has like a speech where she's like, oh, these are your lost cause, and like making all these little connections. And yes, I know Bonham's super small, but the way the dialogue was handled in that scene, like, the actress does a wonderful job in anything she's given, but it just reminded me of how stilted Discovery is when it comes to handling, you know, the necessary work of expositing information for the audience to divulge. I felt that at that point in the story, we were already on board with what was happening, whereas the other point of the story may have needed a little bit more buttressing.
One of the things that I've liked about this season so far is that Burnham can be wrong a lot more often. And she needs the advice and the guidance of others. Now, in that particular scene that you were talking about, Thea, she is right, of course. But Burnham's the captain now, and that changes the dynamic. In the past season, she's not been the captain. And so when she's right, she's been like the underdog fighting to prove that she's right, which is something that a lot of audiences, I think, really enjoy and they get behind. Like, America loves its underdogs. But now that she's the captain, if she's right all the time, it's just boring, right? And so instead, she's asking for advice from everybody much more frequently. And then she's obeying that advice or heeding that, or at least listening to it. And I find that a more interesting dynamic. And I just enjoy this show a lot more when because she's captain, she now has to sort of look to other people and they are now the underdogs. And I like that. I like that more. Jim, we were talking before the show started about how we would gamify this episode or even this show. I'm a big fan of this. People that have been watching the show for a long time know that I'm always trying to figure out, how the skill challenge is working in this particular encounter or how the dynamics of the characters, how you gamify a particular scene. Mm-hmm. This was a very unique episode in the way that it's structured. It's all about subplots. Can you do that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I was mentioning before we started that this episode was like how I like to run my Star Trek campaigns, especially like after 15, 20 episodes, once the players are really, really comfortable with their characters and they're comfortable with each other and we're at a place where we can feel comfortable, like just spending 3 hours of a session. Like, you know, I might have a plan for the episode, like because I'm the game master, but if they want to just, you know, let's just do a subplot session. Let's just kind of like wrap up some of the stuff that's been going on. And then that gives me an opportunity as game master to kind of like drop in some plot hooks that I could weave in to maybe preview some of the things that I would kind of want to explore coming up and just give the characters a chance to just like do stuff, like go to a bar, like, you know, Culber and Adira and Saru are in the new lounge. Like, we haven't seen that set before. So they're in that new lounge that happens to have a dartboard and a Ferengi bartender and a Lurian at the bar. So I was like, hey, look, it's DS9. I'm so happy. But for like gaming this session, it was like, this is perfect because this is exactly what you want in an RPG. And I mean, honestly, I spend time, you know, peeking at what other people are doing for the game. Cause like, you know, at this point with technology, you know, people can record their sessions and put it on YouTube or Twitch or whatever. And, you know, every now and then I'll pop in and I'll watch 20 minutes or something just to see what they're doing. You know, I don't have time to watch a full, you know, 3 hour, something from somebody else, but that's exactly what they're doing. They're doing subplots and they're exploring the characters in ways that you don't often have time to do in 42 minutes where you're doing the slam bang action and things are happening and you got to save the galaxy or whatever. We talked about earlier, they're giving the characters a chance to breathe, right? So for like, you know, if I were gaming this session, the only time I think anybody rolled any dice is when Tilly and Burnham were fighting the Coat Melot. Yeah. When the mercenaries beamed on board the ship and they were like, oh, we're going to do the little fighty bit. And now we're going to go back to talkie and discovering and stuff. And I guess there might've been a skill check for Burnham when she was figuring out that the cryo stuff was broken and she had to fix the cryo stuff. I mean, yeah. It was clear to me, like Tilly, she sabotaged the engine, but like it was easy to fix. And she was just vamping so that Burnham could get the expository out. And that was one of my sticking points with this episode, honestly, is like, I think Talira, whatever her name was, knew it. Like, I don't think she was that dumb to realize that, oh, you know, Tilly's got to fix the engine. Of course, you know, it can't possibly be that difficult to fix it. Right. But I think she was like, okay, what's Burnham going to say? And, you know, maybe she was conflicted or something, yeah. But that was one of the sticking points, is like, does she really think that Tilly sabotaged the engine and needs 10 minutes to fix it? Come on. But so game wise, like, I think the only time you needed skill checks would have been that early part of the episode where they were fighting, the whole stuff with Adira and Gray even the stuff with Book and the Vulcans, like none of that needed a skill check. That's all role playing, right? That's the game master giving the players opportunities to do stuff and just sitting back and watching the players role play back and forth, which is the best part for me of game mastering, is like when I set up a situation and then the players just take it by the, you know, take the bit and just run with it and just let their characters go back and forth. It's like, I'm just sitting back watching a TV show, right? Cause like they're doing such a great job with their characters. Like, oh, I can just sit here and watch and I don't have to throw anything at you. I don't have to ask you to pick up your dice. You're just role playing. And this is great to see that happen.
That's exactly what I wanted to touch on, your observation of the GM as being almost like an audience member.
Yep.
Back in the early days of gaming, I was playing a lot of Champions. Mm-hmm. And we had this thing called blue booking. It was first discussed in like Aaron Alston's Strikeforce campaign. But mm-hmm. the idea was that rather than doing a regular episode, everybody would bring like those college blue books. Mm-hmm. And we would just role play handing our blue books back and forth. And you would have like six players doing three different scenes that are just all written down, and you would be writing back and forth. And that was the first way that we thought to do it. But then later we came to this understanding that you were touching on, Jim, that there is an audience component to gaming as well as a participant component, right? Mm-hmm. And if you've been in the game for a while and you've come to really appreciate and enjoy the other player characters, you are perfectly content to sit back and watch two or three of your friends role play for 10 minutes. Like, that's not a bad time. That's a good time. And it's a whole shift in the way of our thinking, because we are like, well, everybody's got to have a share of the table and everybody's got to be involved in every scene and never split the party. And, you know, there's a lot of reasons behind that. And I get it. And especially when you're playing the sort of dungeon fantasy games where, you know, the dungeon is designed for the players to always be together, and you have to have the rogue to check for traps, and you have to have, you know. But in a more narrative-based game, players can kind of check their ego a little bit and just sit back and watch two or three of their friends have a cool scene. And there's a lot of fun to be had from that. And that's what we got to have this episode. If this was a role-playing session, it would be like, okay, you know, you two, you three, you two. And we all just kind of go in a circle and watch everybody doing their cool shit. And that sounds like a really great time to me.
Yeah, absolutely. And you hit it, Jason. I think, and I don't know if it's, and this is always something I've been pondering, like, especially now that I'm the project manager and I'm responsible for more than just being a game master, is like, you know, presenting a game, right? Like, do you bake that concept into your game that it's a collaborative storytelling game, and it's not just about like niche protection? And like, you're not, you know, you're a player, right? But there's like that mindset, like, you know, some games are built from the ground up to be like, you are this thing and you get to do this cool shit in your combat or in your skills checks or whatever. And that's a lot of players, and you know, this is not positive or negative, it's just the way it is in my experience, is like, that's all they're thinking about. Next round of combat, here's what I'm going to do. Next round of combat, here's what I'm going to do. And they don't really think about what everybody else is doing. And, you know, maybe they'll appreciate somebody rolling a really good result on their check or something if they're doing something cool for them. And sometimes they'll watch it and say, oh, what's the wizard going to do? Or what's the spy going to do or whatever. But it's like a shift, like you were saying, and I've only seen it in Star Trek. And I don't know why that is. For like all the games I've either run or played, it's only ever been Star Trek, like even Star Wars or Lord of the Rings or D&D or other games that I've played. Star Trek is the only one where I've seen the players often will come to a session and be excited more to see what the other characters are going to do as opposed to what they're doing. They're like, I love your subplot so much. I want to see what's going to happen. Like there was a, you know, a chief engineer who was infatuated with one of their officers, but they had to be professional and they wanted to kind of make it work. And they, you know, there's just this whole thing. It was like completely nothing to do with the main like meta plot of the campaign or whatever, but it was like this intimate character thing. And it's like, I want to see what happens next. I'm coming to the next session. You know, of course they're playing their character, but they were like, I want to see what happens to the commander, because like I want to know what's happening with that relationship and how's it going and all this stuff. And it's like when you get to that point in the campaign where your players care about the other players' characters so much that they don't care what they're doing, and they're not like they're not concerned about what cool thing they're going to do in the session, and it's like this more collaborative like ensemble kind of thing. Yeah. That's like gold right there. And you know, when you find it, you hold it for as long as you can and hope it doesn't go away because it's really, really fun when it happens.
Yeah. Well, I think that comes from Michael Pillow, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like before Michael Pillow takes over season 3 of Next Generation on through to, I think, 6 on to the end, the episodes A aren't good. And B, the episodes, they have the discovery problem, right? Like the so plot laden and the characters have no time to breathe. There's no reaction time. But then Pillow comes in and he's like, no. We're going to calm down. We got 22 some odd episodes. This is going to be the Riker episode. And yet all the other characters will factor into Riker's episode. But for the most part, like he has the dilemma. He has the resolution. He has to have the character moment. And yes, it resets at the end of the episode because it's episodic and, you know, they don't know when these episodes are going to air. So not much can carry on, but like the audience has been primed. And that was one of the struggles with Discovery that we have had is like, this is not Next Generation writing. This is TOS writing. This is, we have a core group of 3 people and everyone else sort of rotates around those 3 people. And I think it's wonderful that characters and players can be invested in another person's thing, being like, hey, I'm going to show up, but I really need to know what is happening to my crewmate, what's happening to my friend.
Yeah.
And that's a very sort of like Next Generation era element.
Mm-hmm. As a teacher, I often found good models to be useful. And I wonder, Jim, if that's one of the reasons why you see this in Star Trek Adventures and not in other RPGs, is because we have such great models to work from, right? So when people say, well, how do you play this game? And the answer is, well, you play it like a Star Trek episode. And so we kind of know what to expect. We have a certain level of, so we expect subplots from it, right? Whereas when we don't have a lot of great role models for that in other genres. Now, the exception, you would think that a Lord of the Rings game in which the Fellowship breaks up and you've got Frodo, Sam, and Gollum going off on one mission and you've got Gimli, Legolas, and Aragorn chasing hobbits. And, you know, and you would think that a game, a story like that would encourage the group to think about subplots and sitting back and watching, you know, the other players play. Mm-hmm. Thea and I have a long history of playing Ars Magica together, which is a, you know, historical medieval fantasy game set in the 13th century. And that game has a phrase that they use called troop role playing, which you were getting at, Jim, where everybody is kind of part GM, you know, and we all kind of, and you're all kind of a little invested in what everybody else's characters are doing. And we were able to get into a lot of this in that kind of a game, but we did it. I modeled that game again on a television show. I structured it. I called it HBO Ars Magica. And we imagined it like a television show with seasons and stuff. And I think television is where this subplot really flourishes, right? That's where the subplot structure really flourishes. And so whenever you make a game that's based on a television show, well, now we know how to play the game because we want to make it, we want to emulate what we see on the television. And Star Trek has a lot of great pointers to help new players break out of old habits and try to simulate or emulate what they see on in a 45-minute episode.
Mm-hmm.
And that usually involves a lot of scenes with 2 or 3 people sitting in a bar talking, you know. And when that happens, everybody expects it. They're not like, well, where's the dungeon? Because they know that this isn't that kind of show.
Right.
I think you know, to your Lord of the Rings plot point.
Yeah.
Yes, globally with the Two Towers, those subplots going in, but the way the Two Towers is structured, it's structured in books within the book, right?
That's right.
So the subplot is the main plot of Aragorn, Legolas, and Gimli going, you know, chasing the hobbits to Isengard. And that's the whole central plot. And then you get to the next thing, which is Sam and Frodo with Gollum crossing the Dead Marches.
That's right.
And that's the whole plot. Like, so it doesn't cut back and forth to that. So it doesn't sort of like, they're not subplots. They're subplots in the war against the One Ring, but they're not subplots within the structure of the narrative.
The movie cuts back and forth.
Yes.
But in the book, it's more like two completely different campaigns, right? Mm-hmm. Like Frodo and Sam's players both moved to California. And so the GM
Bill is Wednesday out. Nights.
Yeah. Uh-huh. And the Aragorn Legolas Gimli game, that's on Tuesday night. Mm-hmm. And yeah. Because those two players just could not get along. So the GM had to split the half. What have we missed? Thea, go ahead.
There was one other shout out I want to give because we did talk, we touched a little bit on Trek Fiction, which was unexpected delight. I'm so happy I got to do that. But this episode, we have another shout out to the books in 1983's Diane Duane's The Wounded Sky, because the president mentions this very particular Vulcan technique of suppression emotion, and that is name dropped from that book.
But
that's the thing that Spock's going through in Wounded Sky. Mm-hmm. Because I think that's like the 13th or 14th novel in the old pocket books TOS continuity. Mm-hmm. So I'm really happy that, because now Discovery is so far removed from our frame of reference of what Star Trek is supposed to be.
Yeah.
Hence why we get the new technologies that you know, appeal magical. Like, no one ever explained to us what a tractor beam was when they saw it using tractor beams. They explained it after the fact, but you know, when it was happening, it was like, oh no, we just have a connection cable. But I love this fact that we've gotten to a point where we can now take novel continuity for Vulcans in specific, because Naval comes from that short story we talked about last season, and we can actually just start picking and choosing what we like, and we don't have to necessarily do the Star Wars method of, okay, everything published by Dark Horse is gone. Everything published by, like, we're rebooting it like it's a whole reboot. But, like, Star Trek has that freedom to be like, no, I'm going to name drop this thing. Mm-hmm. And there's going to be, like, a whole bunch of fans who are all excited about it. But it's going to be the vocal minority.
Yeah.
And that excites me.
Mm-hmm. Vance has one scene in this episode where he gives a memorable quote comparing everybody's role to parts of the symphony.
Uh-huh.
My one genuine laugh out loud moment at the end, when she's like, that's a lot of metaphor. And he's like, well, they pay me by the word. Mm-hmm. And he delivers it so well, so smoothly. I'm so glad Vance turned out to be a good guy and not the evil admiral that a lot of us were afraid he would turn into last season.
Mm-hmm. It wasn't paid by the word. It was paid by the letter.
Paid by the letter.
And I was like, you know what? That is, Dickens would be proud.
Yeah, and you know, Jay, that's one of the things I appreciated about this episode, and that I've actually appreciated about this season, because like for the first time, I feel like this season is a natural progression from the previous season, right? Because like if you look at season one and season two feel very different, and like they're kind of connected, but like the characters, there's so many new characters in season two because you bring in Pike and Spock and Una to like, you know, get them ready to launch off Strange New Worlds. But it just, there's this huge tonal shift from season one to season two, and then from season two to season three, everything changed again because they jumped, you know, 900 years into the future. And I'm like, I want to sit with these characters for a while. I want to get to know them better. I want to spend some time with them. And then it's like, oh, okay, now we're in a whole nother season. Now, you know, it's like they reinvented themselves two times over. And now season four feels like a natural progression from season three. And like when you can take a supporting minor character like Vance and just like give him some cool lines, it made me feel like late DS9 series, where they had such a huge cast of supporting characters and they were able to drop them in and give them meaningful things to do. And you're like, yeah, that continuity feels good. So I was frustrated because there's just hasn't been great continuity for Discovery other than the prime actors, right? You got Burnham, Saru, Stamets, Culber, right? Those have been kind of the consistents. And, you know, I just wish we would see more of the bridge crew, because, like, I love Detmer and Owo and Reese, and they were giving them a little bit of stuff to do, but it's like, we're four seasons into this, and we still know next to nothing about these people. And I worry that it's going to be like, it's going to be like Uhura and Sulu and Chekhov all over again, where they're like, you see them all the time, but I don't want to say they're window dressing, because they're a little bit more than that, because they've had more to do, but it's just like, give us more, right? But now they've got these new characters that they have to service as well, and it's tricky to get the writers to focus on the characters, right? And it's like, you got to give everybody things to do, and it seems like Book and Adira and Gray, they got the hot hand right now, because they're great, right? They're great actors, and you want to give them all something to do, and I just hope we get more ensemble pieces. But I do appreciate the intimate stuff that we've gotten in this episode, for sure.
I do love that every scene that Detmer and Owo are in, they give each other significant looks.
Yeah.
We're going to do this. we wouldn't have a plot point, but we're just going to look at each other meaningfully every time we have a chance.
I almost wonder if that's the producers just tweaking the fans at this point. Because, like, I'm sure the producers know that there's a whole subset of the fan base that have already shipped them, and they're like, yeah, they're an item, and they haven't admitted it yet on screen. It's like we're just going to tease you. They're doing these significant looks all the time. But they're never going to show us the scene of them, like, you know, having dinner together, like we got with Paul and Culber, like when they were brushing their teeth in their room together. Like, that was an amazing scene, right? That was like, wow, that was perfect. But I don't know if they're going to give us that with Owo and Detmer. I guess we'll see.
I want to touch on Culber for a minute, because I've noticed something. Culber is serving as both counselor and doctor. Mm-hmm. And there's been a couple of times that characters have gone to Culber for counseling, and we never see those conversations, mm-hmm. which I find very interesting and a very smart move. I think that on television, and we saw this with Next Generation, whenever someone would go to the counselor's office and would get like a conversation, you know, there's a desire in television to present that scene as like some kind of like 5-minute scene where someone sits down with Culber and they come to some kind of realization about their lives and now they're all better. But therapy isn't really like that, is it? Right? Therapy is long and it requires work, and there's no like dramatic epiphany moments. And so our writers on this show are very wisely simply not showing us the actual conversation, and instead showing us the characters putting in the work. Mm-hmm. And I think that's lovely and very smartly done. And I think that Culber's, I love that idea that he's serving as counselor, and we see that in the side effects rather than showing us the actual counseling sessions.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree completely. Although I will admit, this is where the gamer component comes into it.
Yeah,
because if we think of this as a campaign, right? The player playing Culber and the character playing, or the player playing Tilly, like that scene where they're actually talking through the stuff, like that is the role playing gold. That, like, it's like, oh, you know, the Tilly character would say, oh, you know, Tilly's, you know, conflicted and obviously wants to work this stuff out. I'm gonna go talk to Culber. It's like, okay, well, you know, go do it, go do your scene, and like all of us would just sit back and watch. We'd be like hooked. Like we want to see that scene. We like, even though it's not perfect, because like in a role playing session you don't get to edit, you don't get to clean it up in post production or whatever, but just to see two characters in a room that you're invested in talking through the stuff that they're trying to work through, like I appreciate on a TV show, like you can't do that, like you were saying, and like you infer that they have the conversation, and now Tilly's putting in the work, like you said, which is great, because obviously that's what you got to do. You got to put the work in. It's not easy. But like I missed, as a game master and as a player, it's like I missed that opportunity. I want to see Culber talking to Tilly, like, because like Culber is such a great actor, and I mean Tilly's a great actor too. But like Culber, like I just blanked on the actor's name, but he has done so much work in the last season and this season. Like, he's just really they've given that character space to blossom, and I love it. I want them to give him more to do. Like, they've already killed him, right? So they're not going to kill him. I think he's got script immunity now, right? But like this Culber 2.0 is fantastic, and I wanted to see that scene. I wanted to see him talking to Tilly and giving her the setup to go do the thing, Like I was able to make the connection from, you know, A to B that they had that conversation and now she's doing the thing. But like, I was selfish and I was like, oh, as a game master, that's the scene I wanted to see. That would have been the scene for that night to watch. So
it would kind of have to be like the anti scene. Like it wouldn't be able to scene where it reaches a climax, like to do the naturalistic thing that Jason's talking about. It would have to be a scene that doesn't look. I don't mean meander as a negative thing, but a lot of times in therapy, you know, you may go through a whole session and make a minor like connection between two things. And, and that's the takeaway for that week. Like, and then that's the thing you work on that week. I do think it's kind of smart that we're not seeing the therapy scenes because we saw that we saw therapy as a plot point in Winter Soldier, and I don't think it was handled very well. Like it really didn't. It wasn't an authentic therapy session. It felt more like a television therapy session.
I think it's a bit of a landmine, frankly.
So I do like that. I do appreciate it. I get the idea of like I want to see that because I want to see Wilson Cruz. But I also like the funny voice that Tilly does at the end of that scene. Like, okay. Like, that was like laugh out loud funny because it was so silly and so just like, okay, she's so uncomfortable that she's done this giant step that she does like a regression to like childhood in order to walk away. And I love that, like that little human moment. Like I wasn't expecting it. And just like I had to pause it. I was laughing so hard. It was so well done and just oddly human.
She's a great comedic actress. She's got fantastic delivery. The end of this episode very much ends on a sort of calm before the storm moment, right? With Book and Burnham in their room and enjoying the forest and talking about how, well, you know, we get these moments and sometimes that's all that we can ask for. That's all that we can expect. That feels to me very much like a shit's about to hit the fan next episode moment to me.
I mean, it's you know, just thinking about this in like game terms, but also just in you know, dramatic storytelling terms, like they kind of tidied up the room, right? They've got Book kind of resolved, they've got Gray and Adira kind of resolved and ready to do something new. It's like it harkens to that that line that the Co-op Milan had, right? Like this part of your path has ended. Now it's time for a new path. And so like, you know, Adira, Gray, Book, even Stamets, like Stamets is at the end of his path because now he doesn't have any direction, right? He's at a roadblock. So like all these characters are ready to start a new path. What's going to happen next? I mean, even Saru is kind of a little, I got the sense he's a little ambivalent about being back on the, on Discovery. I feel like he wants to be back on Kaminar. Maybe not. Maybe that's just a guess. But like I think they've kind of like cleaned the slate here, and like they're ready to jump into the next big thing. And it's like, is it going to be a big shoe that's going to drop and blow everything to hell, or is it going to be like setting up the next half of the season? To I mean, we're only three episodes into this, right? Which is kind of surprising. I feel like we've been at this longer, but I don't know where they're going to go with this next. And that's probably their intention because like clearly they got this big anomaly that they got to figure out. But other than that big anomaly, it seems like a lot of their other subplots have been kind of addressed and not necessarily put a bow on, but like there's not really a lot of big things hanging. I hope they don't drop the Tilly story because I think there's more to Tilly figuring out what she wants to do and like what her next step is. I think there's more to that. But like as far as like the big storyline, we've hit, you know, we're with Stamets, right? He's got four of the five pieces. That last one didn't fit. The Vulcan smarties said, you know, no, it's not, there's no Tetrions. So what is it? And I think we're going to find out what it is here pretty soon, I have to think. And then that should carry us into the next part of the season. But honestly, at this point, I'm not really sure what's going to happen.
Isn't there a mechanic at Star Trek Adventures where you like rewrite traits for your character?
Yeah, absolutely. So the idea is you can gain milestones if you want as your character progresses. And as you work your way through your campaign or whatever, every character has a set of values that are important to them, right? And you can challenge those values during the course of a session, and then you would rewrite it, right? Showing the idea that your character is changing and growing or regressing, depending. So you can swap out your values. You can also swap out your focuses, like different skill sets that you're good at. You can swap those out and incrementally improve your character as you go. Because the conceit of Star Trek Adventures is that you're starting your campaign already super competent, right? You're not a level one grunt trying to work your way up into the world. You're already a Starfleet cadet or, you know, Klingon warrior or whatever. But you are hyper competent right out the gate. Go off and do your amazing Star Trek-y things like you see on the screen. So it's not really a level-based system. There's not really a lot of things to do to progress your character, which I know some people are frustrated at, is that, you know, what loot do I get? What new thing do I get for my character? And it's like, well, you don't really. You just change and grow, and playing the game and is more the reward than anything else. And like I know a lot of gamers don't like that, right? Because they want the next carrot, right? They want the thing. They want the next buff or level up or whatever, and we don't really offer that.
This is an episode where everybody was rewriting values, though.
Absolutely, yeah.
Like a lot of people were writing new stuff on their characters.
A lot of character growth, even though it may not be mechanical, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
And I love the fact, and this is sort of a compliment to you and your team. I love the fact that every mechanical aspect of the game, like I can point to the episode. Like, well, this is a thing. Like the idea that you can change your focus, like that's Sulu going from botany to helmsman, right? Like, like that's that thing right there. Like, totally. Like, okay, I'm done with the sciences. I'm going into command. Like,
yeah,
that's a shift. I really appreciate some of the more subtle things in that game design.
Yeah. Nathan Dowdell was the main system designer, and he did a fantastic job. Like, I know for a fact that he spent countless hours watching episodes, and because he's a system designer, like I'm not a system designer, like I can do some system design, but that's not my gift. But so he can watch the thing on the TV and like, how do I mechanically replicate that at the game table? And he's able to make that transition, and it's just amazing what he's able to do with it, because like I don't use the full rule set as written, but I use the bits that work for me as a game master, and I've been fortunate enough to have some amazing experiences with it. Right. And it feels like Star Trek, and that's exactly what we wanted it to do. And so we're carrying that forward with all of the new stuff that we're releasing. But yeah, you're absolutely right to be able to, and he packed the core book full of examples too, that were pulled right off of episodes. Like you remember that episode where Spock did this thing? Here's how that thing translates into mechanics. And when you read that, you're like, oh yeah, okay, I get it. I get that. I understand how you can translate it, because it's not just, it's not you're playing a character in the setting. You're actually playing a character in the TV show in the setting. And that's a subtle shift that some people struggle with a little bit, I think, is like, you know, the whole reason that we have the momentum and threat mechanic is to manipulate the drama, like the drama you see on the screen. You're able to do that in the session. And it's not just GM fiat that things happen, right? You're able to spend those mechanical things and play the game, in addition to being, you know, playing your characters and stuff. So, yeah, it's just exciting. Thanks for the good comment.
Well, we should wrap it up, but I want to thank Jim. Thank you so much for coming on the show. It's been a real delight to have you.
This is great. I had so much fun doing this. So thanks so much. I really appreciate it. It gave me an opportunity to think about the series, you know, in a fresh perspective, which I don't get a lot because I'm usually so busy working on the game. But I really appreciate you inviting me. And I had a lot of fun just talking through this with both of you. So thank you.
Well, we'll send you back to the dilithium mines for whatever's coming out next. Adventures.
Awesome.
In the meantime, please stick with us. We'll be back next week with the next episode of Space Force. And thanks, everyone.